Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Let's Clear the Air. We are excited to have our guest on. And as you will see, the host slate is a little limited today. So it's just myself and my colleague, Kevin Broom. But don't worry, we're going to still have a good conversation, still have some good things to share with you all. So don't tune out if you were hoping to see Adam or Brian. I wish they were here too, because they could definitely add some good questions, some good conversation, because I know our guest has got some good information to share. But we're still going to have a good time. We're still going to get to learn some things this afternoon. With that, let me pass it over to our guest. Kendra, do you mind introducing yourself, sharing a little bit about you, and then we can dive into some questions?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Stuart. So I'm Kendra McGregor. I'm a professional engineer. I have a master's and bachelor's degree in chemical engineering. I've been working in the oil and gas industry for 28 years, and I'm the technical director for all things oil and gas processing for Petroskills. As far as my role with the company, I do oversee all of our oil and gas processing courseware, including LNG and LNG operator training. I'm also an active instructor and a primary content developer. And so with that, I do a lot of work in the LNG industry, and I have a lot of in-house clients that I work for in the LNG industry. And so this is actually a topic that I have a lot of passion around.
Yeah. And so just to close the loop, Kendra is very active in GPSA. Yeah. GPSA, for those who don't know, is the supplier organization that is sort of the sibling of the GPA Midstream. So GPA Midstream is the operators, GPSA is the suppliers and service providers, and Kendra is very active, and she is a true technical expert. She's the chair of the GPSA Engineering Data Book, editorial review board. These are the folks who decide what needs to change, what content needs to stay, what content needs to go. And Kendra leads that group, and she's also co-chair of the advocacy committee for the GPSA, and she's on the GPSA board of directors. So I'm not sure when she has time to sleep, but
yeah, you guys certainly keep me busy. That's for sure.
That's always the goal.
So Kendra, we are grateful for one more to-do that you've agreed to do with us, and that's to chat with us this afternoon on our podcast. I think Adam does a good job at asking a fun question to start out our conversations. And so I'll try to do that for us this afternoon. So here we are, we're recording this at the beginning of summer. And so summer vacations are coming up. Let's go around the horn and everybody share, maybe if you have multiple, share one, but what are y'all's summer vacation plans? Kendra, do you want to go first?
Sure. So my summer vacation plan is we have purchased a drift boat, and I am learning how to row the drift boat because we both love to fly fish, and we live right outside of Alcova, so some prime water down there. So looking forward to catch some big hogs and for rowing the boat.
So what is I'm not familiar with that. What is a drift boat?
A drift boat are the boats that you drift down the river that are specifically designed for fly fishing. So the fishermen, well, you could actually have two fishermen on the boat, one in the front, one on the back. The person that's rowing the boat is in the middle, and you can put a motor on them. So you want to go upstream, but the way it works is you drift the boat with the current. So it's perfect speed for the fly fishermen. And then when you want to do different runs, you have to row back upstream to do that same pass again. So
I see. Anyways, so I've seen those before. I just never knew what they were called. So interesting. Yes.
Clack of craft. That's what we got.
Awesome. Evan, what about you? What are you doing this summer?
Let's see. Probably going to go down to the beach and hang out in the beach for a few days. And then the other thing that's a possibility is my son alerted me to the fact that Big Bend National Park, that there is a dark sky area, a dark sky reserve, which is apparently the largest dark sky reserve in the world. down there. And he and I are both space and astronomy buffs, amateur, very amateur in both our case. We have a lot of interest and not a lot of knowledge. And so that's a very distinct possibility, a road trip out there to get a look at the night sky. Apparently you can like see the Milky Way and that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. So
that sounds fun to me.
Very
good. What about you, Stuart?
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, you guys are putting me to shame. I don't have anything quite as exciting. No, my family takes a beach trip every year. So that's the big thing for us this summer. So we'll be in the Florida Panhandle. We affectionately call it the Redneck Riviera. So kind of the Destin area. So we'll be there for a week. And so we're looking forward to that. I'm a big fan of the beach. You know, if people always ask beach or mountains, I'm definitely going to say beach. So it'll be fun to get down there and enjoy the sun and the waves.
Destin's a beautiful area. I've been there before. Yeah. It is beautiful.
Yeah. So we're excited. The kids get to play with their cousins. I have an older sister. She's got three kids. So that's always good for them to have some family time as well. So yeah, Kendra, you kind of gave away our little secret. We didn't know, we weren't going to tell people what we were going to talk about until now, but no.
Oh, sorry.
It's fine. No, just kidding. You alluded to LNG, and that will be the topic of today's discussion. You've been doing a lot of research, a lot of work on this topic, and so we're excited to chat with you a little bit about what you've learned and kind of what the future looks like for LNG here in the United States, LNG exports. So with that, you know, you talk about in some of your research and papers and kind of the deep dives that you've done, I guess, how the existing infrastructure will support LNG exports. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what role that existing infrastructure will have versus are there going to be new pipelines needed for these exports? And what does that look like? Is there going to be new production fields that need to be developed or can existing production fields? If that question makes sense, you know, kind of answer and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, certainly. In terms of infrastructure, a number of these facilities, they are putting in new pipelines to feed the gas to their facilities. And depending on the export plant, oftentimes they will have sales purchase agreements to buy the gas outright upstream and have contracts for supply for, you know, a number of years. In other cases, they are acting simply as a midstream service, if you will, where they will liquefy someone else's molecules for them, and then they just charge them a liquefaction fee. So in those instances, they never take ownership of the actual gas molecules. They just provide a direct service. But I think largely when you look at North American LNG, we have many things going for us that allow us to be more competitive than other producers, for example, in Qatar or Australia. And that's because our facilities are taking pipeline transmission natural gas and liquefying, you know, either purchasing or liquefying those molecules. And as a result of having sufficient supplies of pipeline transmission gas, the project doesn't have to do exploration and production to support their liquefaction exports, which allows us to be very cost competitive, especially when you look at our Henry Hub pricing. I didn't check the price today, but we were hovering right around $3 a million BTU. That allows us to be much more competitive because there's less infrastructure that needs to be provided. And then depending on the contracts and how the plans are made, it could be that a pipeline, a different company actually provides the pipeline, has ownership of that pipeline going to the facility. So they may not even need to have that capital expenditure as part of the plan.
I think that's great. And I think, you know, our audience is a mix of folks that are involved in the industry, folks that may not be involved in the industry. And so it's always fascinating to me just how the economics of our industry works, you know, who pays for what, who provides what. And so, yeah, this is just another kind of example of how different people do different things when it comes to providing the service to transport the material or drilling for the material or whatever it may be. So it's, yeah, thanks for sharing and clarifying a little bit.
Oh, sure. Certainly.
So when we think about
that, you mentioned in your article, you talked a little bit about, I would say, like a build out of needed infrastructure. And I know, understand you're saying that we may not need as much infrastructure as some other countries might, but what is the kind of scale of what we're talking about? The scale of materials that would be needed, the scale of, I guess, capital, labor, et cetera. What kind of project are we contemplating as we look to expand LNG?
Oh, just to put things into perspective, and I apologize because I'm going to look at my notes. I don't have these memorized. These liquefaction plants are mega facilities. They're absolutely huge. And so it's not so much about the infrastructure or the pipelines that need to be in place to provide the feed gas, but about the raw materials that are needed just to build the plant. And so to put into perspective, Cheniere's Corpus Christi Stage 1 and 2 project, it's a 15 million tons per annum facility. For those engineers out there, basically I need 715 million standard cubic feet a day for 5 million tons per annum. So you're looking at 715 million times 3 feed rate going through the plant, big facilities. In order to build those trains, there is 200 miles of installed pipe equivalent to the length of the Grand Canyon, 2,300 miles of electrical cable, enough to cross English Channel 40 times. It utilizes 57,000 tons of structural steel, sufficient to construct 8 Eiffel Towers. And it requires 100,000 yards of concrete, enough to build 2 Empire State Buildings. And so when you put those types of numbers into scale, these are massive projects and they're massive capital investments. And a good rule of thumb, you know, just roughly speaking, for every million ton per annum capacity export production, you're looking at spending $1 billion in capital just for the liquefaction plant. So they're big plants. Even the mid-scale trains, they're still mega projects, and they dwarf the size of our typical gas plants that you see out in the field.
What's the time scale on construction of these sorts of facilities?
Well, really, that largely depends. Just assuming that you had your long lead items taken care of and the engineering has been done and so on. I guess I could talk to the Corpus Christi Stage 3. I believe now nobody hanged their hat on this, but they started site prep a couple years ago. But as far as getting the first mid-scale train fully commissioned and online, so those trains are roughly 1.5 million tons per annum. It was a year in construction and commissioning. So actually pretty darn fast, but the equipment was ready. They had a very aggressive construction schedule with Bechtel. And, you know, the other thing that you need to look at is what are the experience of the trades that you have on the ground? I think Bechtel has built a large percentage of the liquefaction facilities that are operating in the world right now. So they have the experience that you need to do fast utilization such as that. And then the other example would be Venture Global. They turned around those facilities exceptionally fast. And I think, again, it was within a year's time frame from scraping the ground to LNG run down into the tank. It was somewhere around.
So, I mean, these are big numbers, big projects. Kendra, have you looked at maybe some of the challenges that have occurred during construction, such as like budget overruns or bankruptcies even? I think there's been an example of that. Could you talk a little bit about kind of the risk that these big companies are taking on and how they manage that risk?
Well, certainly. Just recently, the past year or two, there has been some pretty serious project overruns. And in the one case with Golden Pass, which was rather unfortunate, Zachry, who was their construction partner, actually had filed for bankruptcy. And so as you can imagine, that set the project back quite a bit. Venture Global also saw some pretty significant project cost overruns. And the whole situation right now with project risk, when you're looking at the Trump tariffs, where you have a 25% tariff on steel. And we just looked at the amount of steel that you need for, you know, one of these very large facilities. And the aluminum, aside from that, you're getting pressure from the EPC contractors because their costs are going up because of the labor shortages that we also see in the Gulf. So there's been quite a bit of project cost overrun. And how do you manage that? Really, from my perspective, a lot of these contracts are done with lump sum turnkey. And from reading some reports that were put out by Poten, their industry energy analyst, it sounds like a lot of those contractors are shortening the time frame on which they're going to honor those, or they're rebidding their projects. And so things are getting much more complicated now, particularly for projects that have not made FID decisions, so final investment decisions. As far as the plants that are currently under construction, those project teams have to be managing those costs and keeping track of budget and schedule very closely to try to ensure that the projects come in on budget and on time as planned. But, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of things that can go wrong, especially when you're looking at projects with that type of scope and scale.
If I can just follow up, just curious, Kendra, if you looked at, I don't know if the right word is risk, but just the demand for these LNG exports, did you do any kind of evaluating? I mean, is there a risk that the demand goes away? Like, do the European countries or Asian countries, do they get this resource from somewhere else?
Well, certainly. There was actually just a report that was published this week. Funny enough, you should mention. And there was also an interview done by their president. And I apologize. I'm looking for the actual statistics here.
This is good. This is like live reporting.
Right. So it was the G2 GNL annual report that just came out this week, the 2025 report. According to that report, the global LNG trade was relatively flat, i.e. we only increased by 1%. Whereas 2023 was 2.4%. But basically, in their interview that they did with Oil Search, as the president was saying, that the long-term forecast for LNG remains strong. But the issue with short to medium-term demand projections are increasingly difficult to predict. And the reasoning for that was behind the current volatility in pricing, geopolitical fragmentation, and also uneven economic recoveries in Asian markets. But let me give you an example, just to put things into perspective. So in 2024, Europe's LNG import was down by 19%. But then what we saw, so that was for 2024. They had a pretty reasonable winter. It wasn't super cold, and they didn't have the level of wind droughts that they experienced this year. This year, so far, their imports are up by 23% simply because they had such a tough time this past winter and spring that they had to burn through a lot of their gas reserves. Now they're trying to refill their storage levels to ensure they can get back through the winter. The other thing that you need to take into consideration is the Ukraine war and what's going to happen to Russia pipeline gas. I'm not saying that this is likely. In my personal opinion, I think it's highly unlikely. But if Europe had access to more affordable Russian pipeline gas, then that takes out a huge chunk of the US LNG market right there, simply because we have been providing the backfill for that, those molecules, if you will. I think that there is a lot of potential trade uncertainty. The other thing that a lot of people probably don't have on their radar is that last year we had a very modest increase in LNG export capacity. So you looked at, we brought 6.5 million tons per annum additional capacity onto the market. This is a statistic from the IGU 2025 World Trade Report, and their numbers are slightly different. So they had 411 million tons global trade, and we were actually up 2.4% over 2023. But as far as what's going to happen likely in 2026, you're looking at roughly 54 million tons per annum coming online. That's huge. And so that could very likely result in a price reduction that could lead to a surge in demand, because there's a lot of countries like India, like Pakistan, other smaller nations that are very price sensitive. If that price comes down significantly, then we could see a much larger uptake in demand. But the other risk that, you know, could be out there is if we have a glut in supply, then, you know, we're not going to be able to sell it and make the profits that originally we thought we were going to make. The other thing that is happening now is that there's new technology coming out where companies can provide a floating regasification, floating storage and regas unit of a size that's less than a million tons per annum. And so basically this opens up a whole bunch of new markets for really small island communities that never could afford that level of access, or they couldn't get a normal size vessel in to provide them with natural gas. So there's a lot of different things that are happening in the market. The other thing that I read was an interview with Shell, and it was with their head of global LNG. And from their perspective, they think that there's going to be some nations that are going to switch from net LNG exporters to LNG importers, because essentially they're running out of the gas reserves. And so as a result of that happening, it'll also help soak up some of the additional supply that you're seeing, that you will be seeing is coming online. But I think the other thing that people often lose sight of, because these are big numbers that we're talking about, but when you look at how these projects are built, typically at least 75% or 2/3 of the plant's liquefaction capacity is contracted under long-term sales purchase agreements. And so for the plants that have their contracts, those molecules have been spoken for, and those agreements are, you know, determined on whatever that contractual agreement is. So once the project is built, you're not looking as much, you know, looking at significant risk. Really, I think where the risk comes in is trying to make an FID decision without sufficient sales purchase agreements, because then you're making huge capital investment decisions without ensuring that you actually have those LNG molecules sold and spoken for once the plant comes online.
Thank you for that. There was a lot of information and a lot of good stuff. And one of the questions that I have, because you talked about the possibility of a glut of supply being out there, and then
in 2026 possibly
in 2026. So, but I was thinking about the portion of your paper where you indicated that if all of the pre-FID projects get built in the U.S., that it could end up being 44% of U.S. gas production being, or would it be just LNG production being exported? A couple questions with that is, you know, one, what are the odds that anywhere close to 100% of those projects actually get built? And then number two is, what effect would that have on U.S. domestic supply, domestic pricing?
Well, you know, certainly.
I'm thinking about my electricity bill here.
Well, Kevin, you know, these are very, very valid questions. And so another thing, the U.S. EIA, or Energy Information Agency, just did their March natural gas report. In March, our production was 107.3 billion cubic feet per day. And it was actually 4.6% higher than March of last year. As far as our consumption, we're looking at roughly 89 billion cubic feet per day. And what we exported was roughly 15 billion cubic feet per day, or call it 14% of our total production. The plants that are under construction right now is equivalent to roughly 26 billion cubic feet per day. And so that's an additional 24% of production that could potentially come online. And when you look at those numbers just on the surface, that's a lot of gas that will be exiting the gate. And then the next question becomes, well, will upstream production be able to keep pace? Will we be able to get enough pipeline infrastructure in And what is that going to do to our Henry Hub pricing? And if the production and pipeline capacity and everything that we need, and this doesn't even mention the whole pressure that we're seeing on the power demand side, because you see, you know, there's this huge surge and we want data centers. They're making agreements with gas providers to put in gas fired power gen. I would suspect that there's no way that the Henry Hub is not going to start increasing if and when all these plants do come online. And the reason why I say that is because the other thing that I think people, and I could be wrong. I mean, maybe it'll get to the point where dry gas production, i.e. I can't make any, I don't have any liquids in my gas. So I'm just selling natural gas. If I have a play that, or, you know, if I have an asset that's like that, it's difficult to make money at $3 a million. But once the price starts increasing, then those producers can make money. And I'm sure they will start producing natural gas and come back online. But the other issue that you need to think of is that much of our gas is associated gas, i.e. it's associated with oil production. If our oil prices tank, oil production goes down, the associated gas production goes down as a result, because those producers make money off of the oil molecules, not off of the gas. And so I think there's so many things that are intertwined in, you know, just the overall oil and gas market, especially when you look at North American operations. There's so many different players. Our contract structures are different. You know, I think that it's likely that our Henry Hub is going to start increasing. EIA was predicting somewhere in about $4 range. What was it in 20? A few years back, we saw Henry Hub at $8 a million. But the problem with a high Henry Hub price is that it makes our LNG less competitive with other locations overseas that are selling perhaps on a crude oil type contract sales basis, if you will, instead of a Henry Hub pricing basis.
Just a question that popped in my head, Kendra, was, you know, we talked about supply, we talked about materials. I guess from a labor force standpoint, what does that look like? I mean, are there enough workers to build these facilities and then operate them?
Well, so that has been some of the challenges that certainly Venture Global, on one of their new facilities that they're currently building, a lot of their cost overruns they were blaming or attributing to increased labor costs. And again, that potent research paper that I read, they said they were reporting that labor prices in the Gulf have increased between 30 to 40%. And the other part of the problem is that all these facilities are largely competing for the same workforce. And that makes it difficult to keep trained people, because what you are seeing is a lot of attrition from your competitors trying to poach, you know, engineers or operations or, you know, maintenance folks. But also, I think we need to start doing a better job in terms of bringing younger generation into our industry, because really, one of those trade jobs is actually an excellent career opportunity, and many of them make over six figures. And so it really is a serious career that is very rewarding. So I'm hopeful to see more young people come into the industry. And that is one of the things that the liquefaction plants in the Gulf are doing, is trying to support their local trade schools and community colleges and providing them internships and doing a lot of, you know, outreach, community outreach and education.
No, that's great. So I think we're about, because we're on third, headed for home here. So we can try to wrap it up. And I guess as we end, Kendra, you know, like I mentioned, our audience is a little bit of a mix between, you know, professionals in our industry, some that may not be in our industry or may not know as much about the midstream industry. And so if you could summarize three key points that we need to remember about LNG opportunities for our country, just what are three things we should take away?
Right. Well, I forgot to mention I do want to say something that is very, very important. Currently, the U.S. is exporting 100 million tons per annum, which is the 14 billion cubic feet per day that I mentioned earlier. But that contributes 40 billion to the U.S. GDP. Sorry, 400 billion to the U.S. GDP. That's huge. We also support an average of 273,000 direct U.S. jobs. And so as far as a benefit to the country, it's a huge benefit. Aside from that, the biggest benefit of LNG, from my perspective, is its ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In many regards, a lot of other countries, for example, Japan and South Korea, have made the decision to try to focus on LNG as a fuel source to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look at what the United States has done as a result of switching from coal to natural gas, we've significantly reduced our greenhouse gas emissions as a result. We didn't talk about LNG as a transport fuel or a marine fuel, but there's a whole other world out there and applications for LNG. So really, it's an entire value chain. And if people are interested, I strongly encourage you to learn more about it. It's fascinating equipment. It's fascinating processing. The facilities are absolutely beautiful. And they really are super clean. If you have billions of dollars worth of an investment sitting on the ground, I guarantee you take very good care of it.
One of the big things I'm taking away from this is just this is one aspect of the energy industry, one aspect of the oil and gas industry. And it is wildly complex and so many facets, so many factors that are all so intertwined. It brings to mind something that Joel Moxley used to say, which is just energy is hard. It's a complex, challenging business, and it's a fun to talk about, and it's just endlessly fascinating to analyze and dig into. So I'm going to just a little prerogative here and ask Adam Murray's final question that he asks every podcast guest, and that is, it's 2-3 years from now, you're coming back to talk about this same subject. What's gone well that's going to make you really happy?
I think we're going to see a lot of really big, beautiful liquefaction plants on the Gulf operating well. I think that is certainly going to come to fruition, especially with the plants that are already under construction or have made FID. I also think the U.S., I didn't mention this, but U.S. became the world's largest LNG exporter in 7 short years. I imagine that we're going to stay number one for many years to come. And I would expect in 2-3 years that we're still going to be holding the number one spot.
Anything else before we wrap up here? No. All right. So I will go ahead and take us out then and just say that we'll be back soon with another episode. We will be rejoined by Adam Murray and Brian Nix, our regular co-hosts. And thank you so much, Kendra, for joining us today. This was great. We should definitely have you back on because it just feels like we've just nicked the surface here on this topic. And there's lots more we could talk about.
Oh, certainly. I'd be happy to come back. And thank you for the invitation. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.